The Tom Woods Show, episode 2233.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you enjoy the Tom Woods Show, it's time to go to the next level. And next level, Tom Woods, is libertyclassroom.com. This is where my friends and I teach all the stuff you did not get in your conventional education, history, economics, and more, the way it ought to be taught, with all the content they left out or distorted. Check it out at libertyclassroom.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. The great Ryan McMakin is back with us. Hasn't been too long. We talked to him not too long ago about his brand new book called, Ryan, what's the name of your book?
Breaking Away.
Breaking Away. And of course, you can imagine what that's about. You should have heard our episode on it, on smaller political units. Of course, we would like the smallest possible political unit, but you got to start somewhere. But I want to talk to Ryan about a couple of pieces he's written over at the Mises Wire at Mises.org about the housing situation. I mean, man, housing is such a politically influenced sector of the economy, partly because of politics, because of federal policy, but also because of the Federal Reserve System and the effects that monetary policy has on it. And, you know, in part, that's because people generally tend to borrow money for homes. So that's why they tend to be interest rate sensitive. Most people, it's not absolutely unheard of, but most people don't just show up with a suitcase full of cash and just dump it on the owner. So it is going to be influenced by monetary policy and interest rates and stuff like that. So Ryan, first of all, let's start off with a confession on your part. You had some kind of government position related to housing. I don't think there's any moral problem with it, by the way. It seems like you were doing morally neutral things there. But, you know, we have a very sensitive audience here. I just want to prep them.
Yes.
So you spent some time, I guess, within Colorado doing work related to housing. What kind of work was that? And in the course of doing that work, did that prepare you to analyze housing and housing trends more generally?
Yes, I worked for 10 years at the state of Colorado in their department of, or division of housing, which is in their Department of Local Affairs. And I did their research, basically. So we looked at average rents. We looked at foreclosures. We looked at home prices, all of that data for the state specifically, and then compared it to the nation overall. And this was a nice spot to be in because it was totally non-political and I wasn't involved in any policy or anything like that. It's just people would come to me for information and I would give it to them. Another nice thing about it was just the state government was so small in terms of like personnel, right? There's just not that many people doing it, especially at the level I was at where you're just like right downtown near the Capitol and everything. And I didn't even have to, I could put out press releases and stuff on home prices and such, and I didn't even have to run it by the governor's office because I was so non-political and didn't tie it to policy or anything like that. At the federal level, it's totally different where any sort of data you're going to put out through like the Bureau of Labor Statistics, you got to have the White House like sign off of it and it's some big controlled affair and everything. Fortunately, it was much less choreographed at the state government. So I got to just look at what was going on with trends in the state, talk to private sector people, you know, apartment owners, the Realtors Association, stuff like that.
And what was the time period on this, by the way?
This was 2004 to 2014. So that was my last job before I went to the Mises Institute.
Okay, so you were there then during the big crash.
Yeah, we also, by 2006, we had a big foreclosure problem in Colorado. And so we had actually kind of seen it coming before it became national news. And so I had some nice, interesting stuff to do in terms of talking to major national lenders and sharing data with them. And you would talk to the sorts of people who are running organizations like Countrywide Mortgage and IndyMac and all of that sort of stuff. And so it was, you got a little bit of a glimpse inside of what loss mitigation and their anti-foreclosure efforts and all that stuff looked like in these organizations. And boy, was it a mess because nobody had any sense of how booms and busts work. Nobody really understood what was going on. So it was really interesting to see how the mainstream industry was functioning within this environment of of low interest rates, of this housing bubble being blown up and all of this stuff. There was so much bad economics going around, but it was quite remarkable.
Oh, I bet. But how was Colorado? And obviously, when you talk about Colorado, it's a big place. And so maybe there are cities that did worse, or maybe the whole state is not, you know, homogeneous. So I don't know how much you can comment on it. But how was Colorado, or how was Denver compared to the rest of the country in terms of, because there were some parts of the country that were hit not quite as hard as others.
Yes. Well, it didn't have the woes of a place like, say, St. Louis or Detroit or these sorts of places where the bottom completely fell out and really didn't have huge declines like a lot of cities just in general. Colorado's been kind of in the middle on so many things, like in terms of taxes, regulation, population growth, all of that stuff. And they had some pockets, especially out east. So the place, say, for the last 20 years where you build all the new housing is east of the central part of the city. Why? Because it's flat and cheap, and they've already built up the areas next to the mountains where everybody's always wanted to live. So what you did have was some cities like, say, Brighton, Colorado, which was north of the city, or Aurora, Colorado, which it's a Denver-sized huge city. It's like the number two city in the state, just east. And so you had huge housing developments going up in those days, and you just had some areas that just had vacant housing. It was never as bad as Las Vegas, but you did have some whole neighborhoods where, right, it was like half empty for a period of months, and the bankers didn't want to really foreclose immediately because they'd rather just somebody be in there living for free than the house be vacant and have squatters come in. So you did have that happen in pockets, but in many parts of the city, it just wasn't like that because it was localized to where there was huge amounts of new production. And that kind of relates to what we'll talk about here a little bit later, is that there was just so much housing production back then that you had a lot of stuff that was just primed to be empty. And it's not like that now.
Wow. Okay. Well, let's fast forward, though, to today, to what's going on today, because people sometimes say we're in for a repeat of what happened back then. You've written a couple of pieces I'm going to link to at tomwoods.com/2233 on this very topic, on housing right now and on monetary policy. You had an interesting examination of the trend in the size of houses. What can you talk about in terms of, I mean, obviously we all see the interest rates are going up and that affects it, of course, but would you describe this situation as being comparable to the bubble of 2008, or are there different features, or is it not a bubble?
I would say, yeah, it's a bubble, but it's definitely different, and there's different causes, and we'll probably have different blowback that comes out of it. So the 2000, well, I don't know, what do we want to call it? It's from 2003 or so to 2007. That was driven by a whole lot of home price construction, or rather new home construction, and elevation in prices because you had declining interest rates and you also had a lot of lenders just giving loans to basically anybody. So in those days, you had a lot of the what are now called liar loans. These things where if you had basically a pulse, the bank would give you a loan. So there were so many people getting into homes with adjustable rate mortgages, subprime stuff. And they were just building as fast as they could to accommodate more of that stuff. And the Fed had entered into a deliberate policy, and this has been covered in some good research on Greenspan and his era, where they decided after the 2001 recession, the dot-com bust of 2000, that they were going to stimulate the economy by putting in a bunch of easy money. And they anticipated even then, they were talking about how at the time this would drive a lot of new home purchases and home price inflation, basically. And so that was seen coming. And then it continued for a period of years. You did, as early as 2007, you started to see prices come down again, but you didn't really get to the financial crisis until late 2008. And so they didn't stop building, really, even though prices started to go into decline. They didn't really cut back on building until it was obvious, until it was just in their faces in late 2008 and in early 2009 that they had a big problem. And that's when you then ended up with empty neighborhoods in some cases. And of course, in some parts of the country, you had like whole condo towers that had like three condos sold in them. That was a thing going on in Florida at the time. So that was its own thing. that was a little different because it was driven by just so much construction. I think what's different now is that there was so much money added so fast to the economy in the last few years that if you look at the numbers, just the way it's inflated home price growth just in the last 24 months or so, it's really quite remarkable. And that's really more of an issue of just so much money. The new home construction has been increasing, but they were already behind in terms of producing new housing. And so I think it's been mostly a money-driven inflation now, the bubble we see, not so much a bubble in new homes coming online.
The last housing problem we had, one of the big stories was the subprime market, and that this was supposed to have been caused by, I think, in part, as you say, by people getting loans who wouldn't otherwise have qualified for them, just because these were really heady days and everything seemed to be so robust and there seemed to be so much money to go around. Why not make these loans? I mean, in a way, it's like the analogy I've used before is like, I always hated in gym class when the captains would pick people to be on the teams, because of course I would always be chosen last and it was humiliating and I hated it. But the thing is, if, you know, let's say there's a pool of 50 kids to draw from and, you know, each side can pick X number of kids to be on some team, but then all of a sudden you're told, oh, by the way, you can now pick three extra. The three extra you pick are, of course, going to be worse than all the ones you had already, because you're going to go for the best ones at the beginning. And likewise with banks, they're going to go for the most creditworthy people at the beginning. And then suddenly, if the Fed engages in credit expansion, well, now, okay, now there's all this credit sloshing around. Now I'm going to go back and find those people who did not seem creditworthy before, and I'll extend loans to them. And so some of that began to happen. But right now, I don't actually know. I mean, I do hear some stories about like the FHA now is willing to, you know, back houses that are enormously expensive. I mean, we do see some of the governmental, like the federal policies on the federal side, a little bit seem to be mimicking what we saw in the years leading up to 2008.
Yeah, it's really remarkable how much prices have gone up. I mean, a lot of the houses you look at now, the loans that accompany them, they would have been considered jumbo loans, something rare,
right,
and remarkable 15 years ago. And now this is fairly standard stuff. The credit that they require, the credit score is higher. There's not as much in terms of just selling homes to people who are highly questionable credit risks under normal circumstances, right? If unemployment starts to go up significantly, all bets are off, right? I mean, even people with good credit scores suddenly won't be able to pay their bills. And that's when you'll start to see significant increases in foreclosures. But even with tighter requirements now, the prices have just continued to soar. And because I think they figured out just with so much money, they can get away with just increasing prices more and more, right? There's bidding wars. People are willing to pay more and more because what really matters is the monthly payment. And with mortgage rates getting down to, right, if you had good credit, 2.5%, 3% for tons of people, you can get this really expensive house and still make the monthly payments. And so that really frees up the builders to build larger, more expensive houses too. And then you've got this big stock of much larger, more expensive, more costly housing, which also uses up more resources and pulls resources away from smaller, cheaper homes. And you mentioned the size of houses. And I've looked at that over the years. You know, when I started doing a lot of that, it was in the context of the issue of, I'm sure you've noticed this, Tom, there's kind of this feeling among like some nostalgia types, like some conservatives, that our grandparents had it so much easier than us. And they were working like 38-hour weeks and they never thought about their jobs over the weekend. And mom never had to do any work. And I guess she was hanging out at the country club or something, learning some Italian to go watch some operas and stuff. There's this kind of feeling that 60 years ago, people had this amazing high standard of living and we're just working like dogs now to afford what they had. And that's, of course, completely untrue. Houses were much, much smaller 50 years ago. People had one car. They had 900 square foot houses. They were doubling up in the bedrooms. And so I had spent a lot of time looking at, okay, how big are houses now versus in my grandparents' generation? How many cars did people have? what was their standard of living just in general? And of course, it was much, much lower in the past. And the truth is that houses are much bigger, and not just bigger, but nicer in many cases.
More amenities.
Yeah, more amenities. And also the whole thing about how they don't build them like they used to. Well, yeah, if you bought a nice house in the 20s, it was amazing, rock solid thing with a brick exterior and all that. But a lot of that post-war stuff that they were building, it was garbage. I mean, it would last maybe 30 years or something. And the reason it's still standing is because people put a lot of money into it, improving it, putting new siding on it, adding some masonry and things like that. But now builders are just cranking out stuff like that. It's much nicer. It's more expensive. It's all wired for air conditioning and cable and all of that stuff. And there's no downward pressure on that because there's so much easy money that you can get from the central bank. So housing is just getting bigger and more expensive. And you would have thought it would get smaller as households were getting smaller, because they are.
They are,
yes. People are having fewer children and all of that. But that's only in the last few years have you started to see home size really peak. And it's still, of course, way above where it was in the, say, the 60s and 70s.
Incidentally, I'll just say in parentheses, it's not directly related to our point, but we bought an investment property here in Florida maybe a little over a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago. And I did it because I was convinced that it would be a good idea, and it has turned out to be a good idea. And part of what made it an interesting episode in our lives was that we wanted to get a property in a particular area. And properties in this particular area were just, they would go on the market and instantly somebody would grab them, instantly. So with this particular property, I found out it was on the market. And so within 5 minutes, I had a call into the realtor. But this guy wound up having a dozen people within the first hour express an interest. People were making offers sight unseen. So there was no haggling with the owner. Forget about that. It was a seller's market completely. And so every bid was above asking. But it didn't matter. I knew it would pay off. It's fine. The asking price was too low. So we grabbed it. And since then, it's been appraised at way beyond what we bought it for. And I think what was going on in that particular case was less the national trend and monetary policy than it was Florida real estate under Ron DeSantis is very valuable for people who are fleeing other states. And I just felt like it's going to continue to be valuable. People are going to continue to be fed up for one reason or another. And they're going to, even if COVID passes, they're going to remember Florida as some kind of a haven, just generally in their minds. They'll conceive of it as some kind of a haven. So we bought it. But I've never seen anything like that red hot housing market. And I think it's specifically in Florida, it's 80% a DeSantis phenomenon. I just pulled that number out of thin air.
Yeah, well, any place where you have strong desire for relocation, right? And
yeah,
as long as you don't have people moving away, that's going to put upward pressure, right?
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, and we're observing economics 101 in action. We did that. Let me bring up, Thomas Sowell wrote a book probably around 2009 or 10, and I think it was called The Housing Boom and Bust. And what was interesting about it was not simply that he cited my book, Meltdown, which made me happy because I've admired him my whole life. My book, of course, is a demand-side book. It's talking about artificial stimulation of demand for houses, that this was not just some natural, spontaneously occurring phenomenon, but it was the result of dual policies, monetary and fiscal. But Sowell was emphasizing largely the supply side. And he was saying that, of course, as you have mentioned in one of your recent pieces, there are restrictions in a lot of places on the local level on supplying new homes, on building new homes, and that this too is keeping prices high, as would happen with any good whose production is artificially kept low. So what can you say about that particular phenomenon, the suppression of the building of new housing?
Yeah, there's so much going on at the local level that really suppresses the creation of new housing. And it should be noted, of course, overall, that real estate's one of the most heavily regulated industries in general, right? From everything from like federal financial regulation right on down to what you can build where and what the zoning is. But you do find it's at the local level where straight up, it's difficult to build a lot of housing at lower prices. And I did that in a recent article, just looking at some of the restraints on that. And every now and then, the New York Times has a really good article. And they had one on this topic, which the title was something along the lines of how builders can't really build starter homes anymore, even though they would like to, right? So often, builders are actually villainized. And the narrative is that, well, they only want to build big, giant houses because the profit margins are larger. And that's what people really want, are giant McMansions and all of that sort of thing. Well, of course, some people want big houses, and there's more demand for big houses than there used to be because of the easy money. But on the other hand, there's also people with more modest incomes who would be quite pleased to build or to buy a fairly small three-bedroom house, maybe without even a basement. Basements are standard out west. And so, yeah, a two-story, three-bedroom, one-car garage even. There's a market for those things if you allow builders to build them. They would have to be built on small lots, of course, because land is getting more expensive. But people do like single-family homes, and a lot of people are perfectly willing to live in a modestly sized one. But the question is, well, are they allowed to do that by the local governments? And I know there's this reputation that city planners have in many cases where city planners want everyone to be in tiny apartments in very dense cities, and nobody should be in single family homes, and there should be no parking, and everybody should be forced to take public transportation and so on. Now, that's true in some places. That's true in cities that are run by rich white people who want to live in what David Brooks used to call latte towns. These are towns where all of these left-wing people just hang out at very nice sort of niche coffee shops and talk about how horrible right-wingers are and that sort of thing. And yes, in places like that, everybody imagines that they should live in a place laid out like New York City, and everyone should ride the trolley and the little train and all of that sort of thing. But that's not true everywhere. There are lots of local governments where actually the impulse is in very much the other direction, where it is, hey, and this is true in Aurora, Colorado, is just one example, but you can find lots of places that have traditionally been very solidly middle class, maybe even working class places, where they've got a reputation for being a city that's not really that nice. It's a place where lots of people live, and it's had affordable housing. And by that, I don't mean subsidized, just affordable places. But they're trying to get a nicer reputation now. So it's in cities like this, a lot of times just suburbs that are on kind of that inner ring, especially, where, no, we want nicer building now. We spent enough years building just little 800 square foot three bedrooms or something smaller with a chain link fence around. We're done with that. We want stuff with masonry on the front. We want nicer houses now. We want to attract a better sort of resident to our city. And there are plenty of towns like that. And they don't want the tiny little houses. They want stuff that's much nicer. So these places are very much implementing minimum lot sizes. They're implementing minimum square footage. They're implementing two-car garage requirements. Those sorts of things all drive up the price of housing significantly. And of course, it then eliminates from many places the so-called starter home, which tends to, of course, be on the smaller, cheaper side.
These are the very people, I hate to generalize, but let's just say a great many of them are the same people, the same sort of people who take this kind of elitist attitude. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with wanting to live in a nice neighborhood. I mean, that's not saying there's any problem with that. But they're the same people who deplore the lack of quote-unquote affordable housing. Well, you know, you can have one or the other, right? If you're going to prevent people from building smaller, more affordable houses, then there will be fewer small, affordable houses. That's one thing. The other thing is, I remember during the 2008 crisis, the panic among the political class when it was seen that housing prices were beginning to fall. Well, again, these are the same people who for years have been calling for affordable housing. Now you finally have the prospect of it potentially happening. Prices are coming down and they're acting like Godzilla has returned. See, their approach to affordable housing is the house is really expensive, but we'll make sure you have access to some loan so you're a debt slave the rest of your life so you can afford the expensive house. Well, my approach to affordable housing is let the price fall and then people can afford to buy the house without tethering themselves to some awful financial arrangement. It's the same thing with affordable education, affordable college. It's not, let's remove the props from the system and let the prices fall. Oh, no, no, no. Let's keep the prices sky high, but we'll just make sure you can get a loan to pay it, and that makes it affordable. I'm old-fashioned. To me, affordable means make it cheap.
Yeah, but you can imagine, of course, the political downside
yes,
that they would experience.
Vested interests here.
Right, is you've got, and of course, there's a very small downside to the general public in terms of declining higher ed prices, right? Obviously, that's very bad for influential people in the higher education sector. And so they want to create fancy colleges, and they've got a partnership with the business community in many cases. And so there's definitely a vested interest there. But with maintaining your home price, right? Well, I want to maintain my home value at very high levels. And there's a lot of homeowners in this country, right? They want to make sure that nothing happens in their town to bring down their home price. So once you're in, once you become a homeowner, you don't want the local government to actually welcome a whole bunch of new home construction, because you could see how that would then bring down your home price. And moving, of course, is very inconvenient. So they don't want to have to move, and they don't want to get a lower price should they then move. And so then they don't want apartments in there. They don't want to have to deal with traffic. So it's not like people who are concerned about these things are bad people. But it is an unfortunate byproduct of the fact that people have so much of their personal wealth tied up in their home and in their home value, at least as they see it. But the other side of that is, I don't like being dictated to where it's, well, you're just going to have to pay more in taxes to make home prices more affordable. It's because those people want it both ways. Is that, well, we want really nice houses. These are the people in local government, right? We want really nice houses. We want everything to be super nice and expensive here, but we also want affordable housing because that's the enlightened thing to do. So what we'll do is, on one side, we'll drive up the price of housing by limiting the amount of construction that can take place. And on the other side, then we'll just make the local taxpayers pay more so that they can subsidize some of these units as well. And so it's just, there's no rhyme or reason to it. It's not a rational way to do it. I think the only way you overcome that is just, you've got to note some realities here, right? Is that it's not like any town that embraces free market real estate is going to suddenly be filled with cheap junk housing and giant high rises. Those only make sense in very specific parts of the city. It's not like you're out in a suburb that's 10 miles out of town and they're suddenly going to start putting condo towers there. That's not the way it works. That's not the way markets function. And so that sort of thing happens much more slowly than people imagine it does. You have to have, over time, density increase, and you've got to have more and more people move there. And that doesn't happen overnight. And there's this more of ample chance to move, to deal with your own financial situation. And you know who actually wrote, it's kind of a forgotten book, but Randall Holcomb, an Austrian economist kind of associated with the Mises Institute, once wrote a great book called Public Policy and the Quality of Life. And he addresses those sorts of issues, issues around zoning and all those concerns people have with traffic and people we don't want in our neighborhood moving in. And he really takes you through a lot of the issues that are related to this, is that you don't actually need a bunch of big brother tactics dictating what can be built where in order to have nice, organic, normal growth within your community without some situation where you're just being overrun by a bunch of junk new housing, because that's just, they're not going to rush in and build that in your community if there's already none there. And so just appreciating, I think, the realities of the way markets work, I think would alleviate this problem a little bit. But because people are just so tied up with their home value, they're just scared stiff of what would happen if people just suddenly didn't control every single city block in terms of what could be built there.
In one of your pieces, you have a heading, "No Easy Money, No Housing Price Boom." Okay, somebody might come along and say, well, that's just an assertion on your part. Is there a way other than strict, well, I don't want the epistemologists out there to get upset at me if I were to say, is there a way other than strictly through theory to know that there's a connection? But I do kind of want to ask you that. How would you explain to somebody that these things are not just fortuitous, they're actually, one is connected to the other?
Well, I recently ran numbers in that article. I looked at money supply growth, and we have, of course, there's the Rothbard-Salerno money supply measure, which is a little bit different than M2 and a little bit more accurate in our view. And it's a more sensitive measure. So it shows the money supply swings more completely than M2 does, just in terms of a variety of effects from, say, short time deposits and those sorts of things. It removes some of the stuff from M2 that shouldn't be there. And so you look at that measure and then you just line it up with home price growth. I just use the Case-Shiller report. And I only did this recently. I'd always assume, you know, people would talk about how, oh, home prices are increasing a lot because of the Fed. And I'm like, yeah, no doubt that's a significant cause. But there's a lot of supply side issues as well. And that's true. But I was shocked at just how closely, with about a 1 year lag, that big increases in the money supply matched up with increases in home prices. And so if you can look back into the 80s and even sooner, really, and you look at just the larger trends, when money supply, when its growth rate lessens, so it's almost always positive, right? But you can have 10% or you can have 2%. So when it decreases, when it decelerates in terms of money supply growth, you start to see several months later a slowing down in home prices. And then you really saw it, of course, it was just blatantly obvious in terms of the connection between the two things, where you had just money supply take off in 2020. And then about 9-10 months later, you saw home prices just take off. And then it even followed the ups and downs of that curve in terms of some of the minor changes in money supply up and down. And then it translated into a similar movements in home price growth later in 2022. So it was really remarkable how close together the two phenomena are, and especially in recent years where so much of money supply growth was just basically helicopter money, where they're just handing out money to homeowners, to people who are now sitting on a few extra $1,000s, and that helped people to just go out and put down more down payments, to feel like they could go out and buy some more real estate. So clearly, there's a pretty significant effect on new money entering the economy and what it does to home prices.
Well, what's going to be happening now that, you know, interest, I mean, we've had low interest rates on housing for quite some time, and almost insanely low. And people who locked those in are in pretty good shape. And now they're actually going up. I mean, they're not going up to where they were in 1980, but they're higher than people are accustomed to. What's that going to mean?
Well, it would seem prices would have to come down, but you haven't seen much of that yet, right?
Yeah, so, that's what I don't get, right?
Yeah. I mean, Case-Shiller, they're like, oh, well, the home price growth is slowing. Yeah, it went from 15% year-over-year growth to 10%. And that's still pretty darn significant if you're looking at buying houses, right? It just hasn't disappeared. It certainly hasn't gone down significantly, if at all, in most markets. So I guess we're just going to have to wait and see what happens there. But it's so built in. And one thing that we could mention is just how out of whack things are, is how home prices, the growth was so substantial, it just started drawing as a magnet private equity and all these big institutional investors. And that's something that gets brought up every now and then too, about how, well, that's what's driving up home prices. But it's really more of a symptom of home price growth, all this private equity interest in buying up a bunch of real estate and renting it out. Because really buying up single family homes and renting them out, it's really kind of a hassle. You got to bring in property managers and all of that. And if yields were higher other places, there's good reason to believe that they wouldn't be bothering with single family houses and doing rental housing and all of that stuff. But home price growth has been so high in recent years that it's now been attracting these larger institutional investors, other than REITs, who, of course, they've been investing in multifamily for years and that sort of thing. But now the home price growth has just been so huge and so bizarrely high that investors that weren't paying any attention to that stuff are suddenly flooding in. And that's, to a certain extent, pushing up home prices as well. Because now if you want to buy a house, you're competing in some cases. It's true about 25% of the time. Certainly not a majority of home price sales are being snatched up by institutional investors, but it's certainly more than it used to be. And so that's just another thing that's going on there in terms of just this home price growth that's so remarkably high. And it's not normal. So with mortgage rates going up to 5, 6, 7%, it would seem it would have to come down significantly. Because of course, traditionally it's inverse, right? You see mortgage rates go up and home prices go down. And of course, there's fewer refis too as mortgage rates go up. So there's just less money going in.
Well, I mean, in case the logic of it isn't obvious to people, most people live on a budget and they have so much money every month they can spend on housing. And if more of that money is now going to be eaten up by interest, they have less left over for the house itself. And so you have fewer people who are able to bid on these various houses. And that means that the sellers have to lower their asking prices in order to meet the buyers where they are. But Right. Yeah, so I mean, ultimately, at some point, that is a fact of reality. That has to materialize.
Yeah, it would have to. Otherwise, you're just going to be in a situation where, I don't know, you're going to have to come up with, well, let's just say it's going to happen eventually, because the only way it could keep going up is if the central bank finds some way to inject money into the economy through other means, right? So you had a bunch of on-the-ground home price growth where you had ordinary people wanting to buy homes because they were flush with money from all these COVID stimulus things and everything. But I suppose if you did as you did after 2009, where you were pouring money then into just the financial sector, where you could have a little bit more activity there. But I think we should absolutely expect to see prices come down, because of course, it's not just the function of mortgage rates going up, but it is that the money supply is slowing. And of course, right, those two things happen to go together in most cases. Interest rates go up and money supply growth goes down. But with the money supply going down in recent months, as it has gone clearly, you're going to see falling home prices. That's the trend that's been holding up for the last 45, 50 years. So it's basically guaranteed at this point. The question is, how long is it going to take? Because we're still sitting around waiting for employment data to change. And that's what would really accelerate it too, is if you suddenly had people losing their jobs, and then they would have no choice, right? A lot of people, they don't want to sell right now because maybe they're locked into these 2.5-3% mortgages. And they're like, well, I don't want to sell this and buy a house at a much higher mortgage. And they're not going to do that until prices come down, if they have the flexibility. But if you lose your job and you can't make those payments anymore, you're going to have to sell. And then they're going to start pricing new sales at the margins there of okay, who's selling? Well, it's people who can't make any payments. And so those prices are then going to go down, and that's going to drive larger decline in home prices in the market overall.
All right. Well, let me ask you then to sum up. Somebody's listened to this. What have they learned about housing in America? Obviously, we've learned that monetary policy affects it and has stimulated it dramatically. Is there something about the future that we can know? First of all, how would you summarize your argument? And secondly, what do you think it tells us about the future?
Well, there's just so much government intervention going on in both the supply side and the demand side, right? The demand side is just pushed up by all this easy money that you can get out there, and which, of course, it's the easy money that impels lenders to knock down lending requirements, to push as much money out the door as they can. So that's driving up demand right there. But is there enough new construction to meet that demand? And there's not enough of that either. In fact, if you look at the data of what happened after 2010, it was really 9 years where you had new home construction way behind the curve in terms of putting out new housing units in relation to the size of the American population. So even adjusting for population growth, there just wasn't much new construction. So too low supply, too high demand. And this is all in an environment of tons of government intervention from every level, right? You've got the central bank intervening at the federal level, even at the international level in some cases, right? Because you've got international buyers in a lot of cases. And then at the most local level, you've got restrictions on supply. So you've really got to look into ways to change that situation. I mean, there are bad ways of going about it, though. I've noticed that in some states, they've done things where they've tried to implement laws that require local governments to rezone, to zone more multifamily housing and that sort of thing. And that's just a recipe for disasters, having the state government dictate to the locals. But people need to recognize that, well, they're affecting their children's ability to live in the same states or the same communities where they are by just driving up housing prices again and again. That's just going to create more pressure for this subsidized type housing. So they're going to end up taking a hit then on all of this stuff about how, well, we're just going to need to create more officially affordable housing. That is subsidized housing. So that's going to end up in your community rather than market rate stuff, which you would have had if you had just deregulated a little bit. And so the only answer, as with so often is the case, is you've got to scale back on all the government intervention and interference here. But just the way that the politics works in terms of people wanting to maintain home prices and in terms of the Fed wanting to just stimulate all the time, it's going to just require some major changes in the political environment for that to happen.
All right. Well, as I say, I'm going to link to your most recent pieces on this at tomwoods.com/2233. Ryan McMakin, heroic writer on topics large and small, A to Z, day after day on the Mises Wire. I don't know how he does it, but somehow he does. And you got facts and figures. And man, I can have you on for anything, practically.
Well, I enjoy being on, Tom. So thank you for having me
on.
Well,
then it works out, doesn't it? Doesn't it work out so well? All right. Well, Ryan, especially this was super last minute. I said, hey, come on, can you come on? And by the way, it was very manipulative and crudely calculated the way I worded my email to you. Because I said, when you said you could do it, I said, and I actually needed an episode to release tomorrow. And I need to have it done one day in advance for my audio guy to get it out. So I said, you know, we could do it tomorrow or even, you know, if you happen to have time this afternoon. So what I secretly wanted was that.
I can read between the lines. So okay.
So you did it. So I appreciate it. Thank you very much, Ryan McMakin.
Thank you, Tom.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.